This episode has been brought to you by the Rampage Network, a webcomics hosting and community site at rampagenetwork.com. For over 7 years, the Rampage Network has brought to you almost 100 different webcomics and programming for people to enjoy. Webcomics such as Supernormal Step, Red Moon Rising, Garanos, Alan, Astray 3, Lols, Blip, Commissioned, Toilet Genie, Plan B, and much more, all at rampagenetwork.com.
News and commentary on the Webcomic Beacon newscast.
It's Sunday, January 29th, 2012, and this is episode 52 of the Webcomic Beacon newscast, dedicated to Dan DiDio, with Eric Kimball from BladeBunny.com.
Greetings and salutations, Internet, and I am wearing pants.
For the first time, our associate news editor, Jason Strasberg.
Greetings, and I'll get my pants in a moment.
And we weren't going to go there on this podcast, but from 910 Comics, I'm Thomas Revor, 910CMX.com. Hope to see you there. But let's go ahead and dive right into the news today. Our top story today is, of course, it's about money. Money. Are cartoonists doomed to die poor and homeless while pirates dance on their graves? Over on ComicsBeat.com, they have an interesting story talking about how the economy of comic books is being affected by piracy. Now, we do a lot of talking about it here because, hey, we're in that business, and piracy does affect even those of us in the webcomic world. But they do bring up a number of interesting things. I mean, for example, comics were going through a slump back in the 90s, and for those who remember, even Marvel Comics had filed bankruptcy, and now it's going back up. It's a boom again, but there's a Tom Spurgeon, and I know I mangled that name. My apologies, Tom. Had said, quote, "There's a bunch of stuff out there right now on creative teams fighting and or dissolving. It's not something I care to link to, but you can find it pretty easily if you look around. The thing that I wanted to note is that this kind of public griping always seems to happen when comics is in a real emotionally stressful period. I think the mini era we're in qualifies for sure." And then he goes on to say a few other things. I mean, other people have been noted, such as writer Joanna Draper Carlson, who brings up some very good things. But it is, what exactly is piracy going to be doing to us and to the people?
Eric? Yeah, I mean, here's the thing, and there are two sides of this debate. And I mean, one of the things is there is piracy going on, and there are properties that lose money due to piracy. There are also properties that actually succeed when they're pirated. So you can have both sides of this, where if something, you know, gets pirated and gets its name out there, it can actually help the producer out quite a bit. The problem you get into is when you have something that, and this is my theory, and you're welcome to argue with it, but when you have something that is known by everyone, then any pirated copy is a potential sale loss because there's no benefit for buzz. I mean, and this is sort of what I'm saying. It's like Batman. There's no benefit to Batman to be pirated because Batman, everyone knows who Batman is. Everyone knows the Batman comic. So piracy is just a loss for them, where if it's an unknown product, it can be a gain. And that's sort of the tension that you see here, where some people say, I made millions of dollars by opening it up and allowing everything for free, where other companies are saying, we can't do that. Our product is different. So it's sort of a back and forth, and it's sort of hard to figure out what's important and what's not.
Well, one
is
of the
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, one of the one of the quotes within the story is from David Brothers, who is a proponent of the digital revolution. And he says that to put forth the idea that piracy on the part of consumers is singly responsible for anything especially when piracy by its very nature is impossible to nail down in terms of concrete numbers and cause and effect, is dishonest. They've been here. Yeah. They aren't going away. Mm-hmm. Do they cause harm? Any idiot knows that the answer to that question is yes. But for my money, the thing that killed comic books is everything else. We're living in an all-new status quo, and I keep seeing people, especially comics people, acting like piracy is the sole cause of all their ills. When no, that isn't true, and half a glance at the world will tell you so. I mean, Brothers is rather blunt, but yeah, he's got a point.
Right, and I mean, it's not even taking into account what's going on in print comics, the business model that they've changed. I mean, the new 52 at this point is basically a stimulus package. Comic shops will tell you that they're actually making money at this point, but I mean, how long is that going to stay stable?
Yeah.
Well, and this has been one of my favorite bugaboos because it's been the number one sales. I mean, every time you come out with a number one comic book, the new number one, it's going to sell like hotcakes. I don't care if it's one of the big titles. It's going to sell. And then reality hits.
Yeah, the problem the comic book industry has is been a problem that has been growing for a long time. And quite frankly, during the collector boom, they got lazy.
Oh, yeah. You know?
And this is sort of they're now at the point where people are saying, you can't do this anymore. You have to write good stories. And they're saying, we don't know how to write good stories anymore. All we know how to do is put foil covers on things. And so you end up with the situation where a lot of people are saying piracy isn't – I mean, the truth is piracy isn't going to destroy an industry. It's competition with an industry. If you want to beat piracy, you have to make your product – easier and cheaper to get legally than it is to get illegally. And I do say cheaper because there is a cost for going through pirate channels. I mean, you worry about downloading a virus. It's hard to find. You have to use all these different programs. People don't want to do it. And if you set your prices reasonably and you made it easy for people to purchase and easy for them to move from one computer to another, then they would go and buy it legitimately. But instead, what they're doing is setting ridiculous prices to keep the comic book shops happy. They're putting ridiculous, DRM on it so that you can't use it anywhere you want. And then they're whining that people are going to pirates. Well, pirates have a better product. Sorry. You know, you've now made a product that's worse than what the pirates are giving out. So why would we go and pay you money for something that's worse?
Well, there was a bit of a tweet war with Neil Gaiman, Neil Gaiman, and a number of others, including Steve Niles, which was kicked off by Gaiman's retweet from musician Jonathan Colton. And Colton had said, quote, make good stuff, then make it easy for people to buy it. There's your anti-piracy plan.
Yeah. That's very true.
But it also comes down to, I'm sorry, even though I wish it was true, you're not going to get rich in the comic book industry or the webcomic industry. There are exceptions to that. This article specifically mentions Jeff Smith, Marjane Satrapi, and Peter Laird. And, I mean, we can point towards the Penny Arcade crew or the Half Pixel crew who have made some money off of their stuff, or Homestar Runner. But they're few and far between. I mean, those are just three examples out of the multitudes of people who do web comics.
Yeah, that is the sad truth. We always see the successes, and the problem is the successes are so few and far between. There's not a good business model to consistently produce results, and that's the real problem. Is that there is we say webcomics are the way. This is the way you can make money, and it is a way to make money, but there isn't any standard model that you can follow with a company and get a consistent profit margin on it. And that's what companies want. They don't want to have the breakout success. They want to say, if we release this product and we do a good enough job, we're going to get a certain return on our investment, and you cannot promise that with webcomics.
Nope.
Okay.
Agreed. And I silenced it.
Yep. And, well, It does all come down to that. We are in a slump of an economy. Things are more difficult to get through. And piracy, depending upon, it can either help or harm. More often than not, it will do harm. But I mean, no matter what happens, I mean, come on, folks, it's still theft.
Yeah.
Next up, an article over on the comicbooksresources.com site from longtime industry hand Jason Thompson, having written a thoughtful essay as to why the manga industry is in trouble. And, of course, using the American scene to point out structural problems in the Japanese market. Now, I'm sorry, I didn't know that the manga scene was struggling in Japan. I know that we had talked about it before the podcast, that there has been a bit of a lull in a lot of the general populace's interest in manga and anime.
Yeah.
But it does give some things of examples from the American print industry, where comic books have, like, the reboot with the New 52, where, because it's got an aging readership, the decline of print, and the reluctance, it says the reluctance of Japanese publishers, but we've seen that with American publishers as well, to embrace digital publishing.
Yeah. Both of these articles go together in a strange way, because one of the things that you read in both of these articles is, 1 year, we made a ton of money. How come every year isn't like that? And that's the sort of reading I get off of this article is, yes, okay, manga is slumping in America. And there are a lot of reasons, and it goes through a lot of reasons why manga is slumping. And I mean, if we're talking about piracy, the people who are getting killed by piracy is the American manga market. I mean, the people who are really getting killed by this is that market, because the pirates can translate and produce a book faster than the manga publishers can. So not only do you get the book for free, you get it before everyone else.
And with some of the translations, a better quality, too.
Yeah, and better quality. And so, you know, this is an industry that really is getting slaughtered by piracy. And you can, it's not manga, because manga itself is still, like you said, doing well in Japan. But the scanlators are just murdering them in America.
But you do have to go through, and a lot of the scanlators that I've seen do have a code of honor, which they are following by, yeah. Where whether it be subbing of anime or the translations for manga, they have stated that, and they've held to it for the vast majority, once it comes out professionally, we don't touch the stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Now, that's something I've never heard before.
Yeah, a good example is the translations, the subbing, which they were doing for the Naruto series. And then once it came over here and was being broadcast, they stopped doing it cold turkey. It became an item which they would not touch because it was being done. And that was just one example.
That's a weird little wrinkle.
No, okay. The scanlators in manga have a really strong code of honor among them. And it's one of these things that they can claim the reason we're doing this is that these companies are not moving out into the American market, and we have to do this because it's the only way we can get it. And one of the things the article does mention is that, you know, instead of vilifying these people, they really should go out and recruit them to work on these products. There is absolutely no reason, if you have a huge group of people who are translating your work for free and who also have some respect for you in that they stop translating it when you bring it out for free, get them to translate your work. There's no reason why you have to make these guys the bad guys. You could have these guys working for you. And when you talk about webcomics, this is the big secret of webcomics. This is the thing, you know, everyone talks about, well, oh, these great webcomic sites. The way webcomics become the powerhouses they are is they start recruiting their fans to do things instead of just saying, you know, oh, let's we're going to do it all ourselves, and the fans are just there to receive our product. The ones that succeed are the ones that go out there and get the fans and say, hey, you like doing this. Why don't you become part of our team and help us out here? I mean, we have Jason here because he was helping us out.
Absolutely. And let's go back to a lot of the manga scene that's out here in America now is because of the Scanlators and the subbers on the anime. I mean, one of the biggest hits from anime is Ranma One Half, which has never been broadcast in the States. And it wasn't even on sale until a few years ago. But it just became a huge hit because of people who saw it over in Japan, started bringing it over, adding on subtitles for it, and letting other people see it. And it populated through the conventions.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's really, I mean, it really is sort of like the old analogy of trying to clasp onto sand. If you're gentle and you just cup your hand, you can grab sand. But if you make a fist, it all goes through your fingers. And that's a lot of what goes on here, is that we have to clamp down on these people and stop them. Well, you're losing a lot of potential for profit then.
And talking about sand, on to our next story, where we're going to be talking about one of the great geniuses who was definitely taken from us way too early. And that was the late, great Jim Henson. Back in the 60s, where he was doing Sesame Street and doing other puppeteering, but he was doing so much more back then. You know, I mean, television commercials, music, he made homemade animated movies. And with a friend of his by the name of Jerry Juhl, J-U-H-L, he created a screenplay for a feature film called Tale of Sand. Well, this story, after 40 years, is now seeing the light of day as a comic book. Mm-hmm. Arkea Entertainment has partnered with the Jim Henson Company to produce a graphic novel interpretation of Tale of Sand. And this mostly wordless comic is going to be a great look at some of the creativity that we've seen from Jim Henson in his early days.
And yeah. If you look at the article, the artwork is beautiful, which is also done by Ramon Perez, who is a webcomicer. It's something I'm really excited to see.
Yes, this story comes to us over at comicsalliance.com, and the artwork, it flows like anything, nothing I've really seen, and very few times have I seen, quote, wordless comics that worked. And this, you can just see the personality and style that went into this, both from mm-hmm. Henson and from Perez.
Yeah, it's a beautiful comic done by a very talented artist, and it will be interesting to see how it's coming out. I think they're doing it right.
Right. I hope it's a success, because I love digging into some of the stuff that that, you know, before the Muppets, but that no one really actually gets a chance to look at. And Henson's work was huge. I mean, there's a lot of things that doesn't fit into that whole Muppet canon that you just want to see, and it's so thought provoking.
Phenomena.
Okay.
And we've got, from Jim Henson to a David and Goliath story. We've talked about this one before, of Rachel Yu, who wrote a book, a 16-year-old who wrote a book called How to Be a Supervillain. And it has dominated the charts, beating titles like Watchmen, Batman Hush, and so many others. I mean, and she just started publishing her own books through the Kindle.
Yeah.
Over at geeknews.mtv.com, they have an interview with Rachel talking about how she got started and the procedures that she's done for creating her stories.
It is a interview definitely done with a 16-year-old girl. and
yeah, I mean, if you want just like one quote from it as a question, her answer is, "My dad keeps an eye on the sales and the top sellers list," referring to Amazon. Mm-hmm. We're all very excited with how the new book was doing. I'm glad that people are enjoying it. It's a 16-year-old, but which is really interesting, because we're still like in the wild west of digital publishing, and that this kind of phenomena can happen.
Yeah, the daily phenomena of webcomics is just what makes it so fascinating, in that the weirder you are, the more likely you're going to get noticed. And this is one of these things where it was just so earnest, the book, and the way it was going about it, it really caught people's attention. And it's an interesting interview to look at.
I'm looking at the last paragraph right now, which I absolutely love. The last question asked was, what's next for her? And she says, well, I'm working on a new book about a space cop superhero. It's basically a funny, light take of comics like Green Lantern or the Nova Corps. Mm-hmm. Nice to see the shout-out to both DC and Marvel. Mm-hmm. Also, I'm finishing up finals and have to study for a bio test next week. Yeah. For dinner, I'm going to have chicken and rice. Too bad there are no more ice cream sandwiches.
I think she might have punched that up a bit. Come on.
Yeah. I it's good to see something like this. And especially on a personal thing, I mean, I used to be married to a teacher, and to see a 16-year-old going through and doing this, I mean, and having the not just the wherewithal, but the talent and skills to do this. I'm glad to see kids getting into reading and especially writing.
Yep, it's awesome. You just got to say congratulations, Rachel.
Yep. And let us know what your secret to success is, because us old folks need it too.
Can we borrow a dime?
But over at the Huffington Post, huffingtonpost.com, they have a story over there about The Art of Foe, a motion comic based on Julian Hanshaw's graphic novel. Now, this is an interesting story because it's talking more about motion comics rather than true animation.
Yeah. I went through both the video about this and the actual motion comics, and motion comics have not found their place yet. And I'm sorry, there was an entire team of people working on this. They really put a lot of effort into it. This was a popular comic. It's just dull. And I'm sorry to say that, but it's a very slow video that you watch that doesn't have a lot of animation in it. It's mostly things sliding on and off the screen, and it periodically asks you to click on things for no reason. And I think it's interesting to see the amount of effort that was put into this and what a professional team can do. And it definitely blows the motion comics that released by Marvel and DC out of the water. I mean, there is actual work of animators in here, but motion comics always just feel to me like animation that didn't quite make it. You know?
You talk motion comics to me as the old guy of the group, and I think back to the Mighty Marvel Marching Society back in the 60s with the Captain America, the Hulk, and the others, where they were basically taking Jack Kirby comics and moving them with a little bit of animation in there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what The Art of Foe is. That's what all motion comics are. And it's trying to see it. You know, the idea is that on the web you can have moving elements. And there's been a lot of experimentation with it, and every time it just falls flat. It just doesn't connect with people. And I mean, it feels like, and I really feel like there should be a way to make a great motion comic, and yet there I've never seen one that really engaged me. And this is another one where they put a ton of effort, and just the video about all the work they did on this is fascinating, and it's definitely worth looking at the video just to see how an animation studio works. But
now, the story itself, sorry to interrupt there, but the story itself is basically was written after a trip that he took to Vietnam and drinking a lot of the street broth there, pho soup. And it does, to me, show a little bit of the culture. And that may be why some people think that slow is because of the culture difference between the common person over in Vietnam versus the way that we Americans live.
Well, yeah, it's it, it is also an indie comic, and it has that indie comic feel to it. So there is that. I'm sorry, Jason, I cut you off.
Well, what I wanted to point out is that also the expectation with a motion comic, I mean, it never really meets it. The fact that I can watch this and there are elements that move, that's great and all, but you know what? I go to another website and I can tell a chicken to dance. So I...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that as a person who's basically online so much, there's so much expectation there and it just does not fulfill.
Yeah.
When there's so much, both amateur and professional... true animation coming out on the web, especially with tools like Flash, which was made for animation and can produce such quality work, again, both on the amateur and professional levels, the expectations for something like this are higher, especially with a number of the webcomics out there that do take advantage of it for their comics.
Yeah.
And speaking of taking advantage of, we're going to go ahead and take a quick break right now while we earn a little bit of money of ourselves by our advertising. And for the WebBeacon newscast, this is Tom Revoir. We'll be right back.
Do you enjoy digitally composed and or remixed music? Love a variety of musical styles? Look no further than LapFoxTracks.com. Over a dozen different composers with individual stylings.
Humanoid in the biosphere. I can hear everything with my super ears. Only feel the way that I'm progressing. Most of the time, that's not to a give a damn.
Well affordable, high quality musical tracks with much more bass than what is technically possible for this podcast promo. Check out LapFoxTracks.com.
This program is a part of the Webcast Beacon Network and is hosted on the Rampage Network. Follow us on Twitter at Webcomic Beacon. Email us at WebcomicBeacon@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail by calling 1-320-310-0922. The Webcast Beacon Network, covering and promoting creativity and the creative process since 2007. Webcomics, comic news, tropes, and web fiction at webcastbeacon.com. Now, back to our show.
Welcome back to the Webcomic Beacon Newscast. I'm your host, Thomas Revoir from 910 Comics, 910CMX.com, along with our news editor from BladeBunny.com, Eric Kimball.
Hello, Tom.
And our associate news editor, Jason Strasberg.
Hello.
Start off, we're going to... It seems that not all is hunky-dory in Riverdale. We've talked before about some of the other problems over at Archie Comics. Well, Archie Comics... about a week ago, Archie Comics co-CEO, Jonathan Goldwater, has sued to remove his other co-CEO, Nancy Silberkleit. And why can't they have a phonetic pronunciation in these stories? And a New York judge has agreed with Goldwater, barring her from entering the company's offices or performing any work for the 73-year-old publisher.
Yeah, it's... This is just... At the beginning, I was sort of feeling, well, maybe it's a honest disagreement between the two, but every time I hear this story more and more, it really does sound like sort of this ganging up on Nancy. Now, we don't know, you know, maybe she's just being, I don't know.
Politics is it? That's the question.
This came about afterwards when Nancy decided to go to a convention representing Archie Comics. And so this injunction came as a direct result of that.
And this was after a previous order ordering her to stop as well.
Yeah. So... It's one of the strangest stories, and just how it plays out, I don't know. You know, and it's really sad because Archie Comics is one of the strongest comic mm-hmm. publishers right now. You know, if you were to look at any comic you say is going to really make it in the transition to digital, Archie is in the best position, except they have all of this internal craziness.
And the craziness goes on. I mean, I'm reading some more of the story. Silberkleit owns 50% of the company. And that's part of the reason why it's co-CEOs. She received it in her late husband's will.
Yep.
But to add to the circus here, that will is being contested by Michael Silberkleit's children from his first marriage. Because this last will and testament was written while he was dying of cancer. And apparently there's just some kinky stuff that they say is going on with that.
Yeah. I mean, it's really hard to know who the bad guy in this story is because it just seems all over the place. Yeah, they're contesting the will. You don't know if they contest the will, then she's going to be forced out. If they don't successfully contest the will, then how do you deal with the two CEOs who hate each other so intensely?
Well, I mean, we've seen that because they're going through the courts and have her barred from doing anything with Archie Comics right now. So, I mean, she's going to become, if the lawsuits hold up, not just the contesting of the will, but the lawsuits hold up, she is going to become a silent partner. Yeah. Or we're going to see the end of Archie Comics.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know if we'll ever see the end of Archie Comics. I think that, the worst, it's not, I don't think it's going to kill the company.
Yeah, it's not going to. What I've been saying, I don't think this will kill the company. Archie is pretty strongly positioned. It's still in supermarkets. It has sort of this loyal following for years. It's a cultural icon. The real loss to Archie Comics is its mobility in face of change, because we know that Diamond is going to die soon, and when that happens, that's an opportunity to Archie, which has more distribution outlets than the other publishers, to really take advantage and really capitalize on this. And Archie has been investigating superheroes and going to digital and creating just a more diverse catalog. And if they can take advantage of the collapse of Diamond, they can really catapult the company to sort of a premier status, overshadowing DC and Marvel. But if they have all this going on internally, they may not have the nimbleness to do it. They may not have the ability to get the funds they need, because 50% of the company is owned by someone who's going to block you. And so it could be a lost opportunity, in my opinion.
And unfortunately, it seems like what going through the courts is going to be the only way that that is going to be resolved.
Yeah.
Always on the forefront of news, NBC News has formed a publishing division. Not just a publishing division, but actually an e-publishing division, utilizing their own digital books and their own assets to create said books. NBC Vice President Michael Fabiano has been appointed General Manager of NBC Publishing, and the company has hired two publishing veterans to lead its efforts.
Yeah.
We are going to see, this is actually probably going to be a good thing to a degree, because we're going to be seeing a lot of those assets, you know, whether it be NBC News or NBC Sports, Dateline, and so many other things, which will be going through and coming up into a more cohesive form. At the very least, there'll be educational books. At most, it could be more than that. I mean, because a lot of the morning shows are going to be the trendy stuff, which can be put out into magazines and periodicals.
Yeah. It will be interesting to see where this goes and see who else follows suit.
Right, and my question is how are they going to, are they going to partner with another e-reader like iBooks, or are they going to go with Kobo? I mean, how are they going to distribute this? And I really don't see that in the article.
Right, and we've already seen one team up between an e-publisher and a news source, and that was when Rupert Murdoch and News Corp, who owned Fox News, teamed up with Apple to create a periodical exclusive to the iPad.
At the daily, right?
Which did not do well at all.
But I mean, it could have been a situation of something for its time. You know, it was an experimental thing, and you know, you've never seen anything before like it, so it probably was going to fail. And speaking about failing, our friend Sean Clayfeld over at MTV Geek, geek-news.mtv.com, is going to run a little experiment. There's an article up talking about how to mentor. You know, contacting newspaper or comic book strip artists. And even though he doesn't say it, try writers as well. We do know a few things. And using that, drawing upon that experience to bring over to the webcomic world. You know, he even specifically says that webcomics are still comparatively new, even though we are 10 years old.
Is this the mentoring experiment you're talking about, that
yes.
article?
Yes.
Yeah, no, in this article, the creators of PC Weenies, who is Christian Savadim, that's a name that needs to be spelled phonetically.
He has
offered to be a mentor to two creators, and he is going to he's going to put all of his mentoring advice online for everyone to read, and he's going to interact with these two creators, telling them you know, how to improve the work. And the reason he did this is because he said he himself feels sort of stymied by not having a mentor himself. So there is a webcomic creator actually going out there and trying to mentor other people on how to make better webcomics. Now, normally an article like this sends me into a rage. The important part about this is, first of all, Christian is a educator and at a university, and second of all, he's doing this for free. He's not charging people for his sage webcomic advice, and he's doing it in public. He's not doing it behind a secret paywall. He doesn't have a secret plan to save comics, as some people do. He is doing it in public, and he is doing it for free, which I think is very admirable. And I think this is something that's going to be very interesting to watch, to see what he does with it. So he is starting a mentoring program because there hasn't been one available for people in the past.
And it's something that people, I mean, I don't care whether it be through this or through other things. I mean, a lot of the people who have been in the webcomic world for a while, like myself or like Eric or like so many others, there's a wealth of experience out there which you can draw upon you know, for people beginning or even people who are not beginning. I mean, you can talk to other creators and learn some of the secrets that they've had, you know, good or bad, you know, see what works, see what doesn't work. That's the great thing about mentoring.
Yeah, I would love to see more webcomic creators do this, of having an official mentoring program, officially going out there and saying, I'm going to mentor these people, and to put their advice up online for free. I think this is a great thing to do, and it's quite a generous gift to the community as a whole.
Absolutely. And gifts to the community, we've got a trio of stories interlocked here. All talking about the recent release of Apple's textbooks on the iPad. Right. Start off, I mean, there was the first thing that they did was release some free software, which only can be used on Macs, folks, where you could use it to create ebooks and not just printed text on the page or the e-page, but with slideshows and video and music and interactive questionings and so many more. Now, there's been a bit of a, as they say in this story over on dailycartoonist.com, there's been a bit of a kerfuffle, love that word, kerfuffle, over the iBooks author licensing agreement. It says that the software is free to use if you're giving away your creation, but if you plan on selling it, can only be sold through the iTunes bookstore, and Apple gets 30% cut of the sale.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, here's the thing. That's standard for Apple. If you're selling anything through Apple, it's 30% of the sale. And the second of all, there is no other market for iPad or iPhone, or, you know, there's no other marketplace to sell it. So, yes, that is a legal restriction, but it's Apple's the only game in town. So even if you were going to sell it, you would still have to go through iTunes and you would still have to pay the 30%. So I don't know how much of a restriction that is. The thing that really confuses me is, what's the advantage to this of this to webcomic creators over a simple PDF? I don't understand that.
It all depends upon the webcomic itself. You know, for comics that are just a variation of the standard comic book or standard newspaper strip, there's really not much. But when you get into some of the other things in there, a good example is The City of Reality by my friend Ian Sampson, who, let me give a quick shout out to, who is currently over in San Francisco receiving his graduation in animation. But,
excellent.
Go ahead and visit him at cityofreality.com and say that we said hi. But, I mean, his webcomic isn't just the standard thing. He's done a lot of experimentation with it, with motion, video, interactivity, which you can't see. And the iBooks author software is probably about the only way that you're going to get something like that into a, quote, ebook form.
Yes, but to go back to our previous discussion about the Art of Fu and motion comics, most successful comics are just images on pages. They don't have that experimental element to it. And most of these items can be put into a PDF without much difference in quality or format. So it's one of these things that it's like, well, Apple's released this new software that can do great things that we're not going to use. I mean, it does seem specifically targeted to textbooks. So I don't know what the advantage to a webcomic creator, a standard webcomic creator, as you said, ones that have interactive elements, fine, but most of us don't.
You know, to me, I see two advantages. One, it does make it a lot easier to put it into a format, and it immediately makes it available to the iTunes Music Store. Mm-hmm. You do have to have a sales permit through there, and I mean, if you're giving it away for free, that's fine. It immediately puts it up. If you're selling it even for 99 cents, there is still a procedure that you go through. But the software is easy, it's available, and unlike a lot of the other software that we use, it's free.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing that kind of plays around the back of my mind, especially with Apple. I mean, it sounds like they're using the same app sales philosophy. And, I mean, is this also going to be subject to review? If I were to put up an iBook with some questionable content, is it something they can take off their site again?
Yes.
That's a problem.
That is in the end user environment agreement. There is a license agreement, and this is Steve Jobs' vision to protect us from porn, and that's what they're going to do.
As long as your webcomic does not have the words "bow chicka wow wow," I think you're going to be safe.
Until somebody reports it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. I don't trust. You know, we will review it, and we're not going to censor you. Trust us. Philosophy, because I can guarantee you, if I posted a comic, if I use this software to say to post a comic, the evil genius Steve Jobs, it would not get approved. Mm-hmm. It would be gone in a second, and that would simply be, well, Apple has a right to remove anything from their store that they want, and they would remove it.
And there are other options as well. The next story, which ties in over at VentureBeat.com, is talking about how to get your self-published comics into so many of the different media formats, whether it be iTunes, the iTunes Music Store, or the Kindle, or Amazon, or Android, or Google Books, or things like that, where a company called Graphically will take your comic or whatever and convert it into all these different formats automatically. That's the good news.
Yeah.
The bad news is that they're going to charge you $150 for a standard 22-page comic.
Yeah, that's really bad news. Yeah.
It's a pre-press cost, basically.
Right. Yeah. And that's per book. So, I mean, that does put it outside the realm of the small press. And the larger press are going to have things that they do it themselves.
Yeah. This is one of these things where they're taking advantage of people who don't know better. And I'm sorry. This is simply trying to take advantage of comic book artists who don't know a lot about the web. And there are a fair amount of the print comic people out there that don't know a lot about the web, and they've seen people make a lot of money independent, and they're simply saying, hey, go through us, give us $150, and you'll be just as famous as these people. And it's a little sketchy, if you ask me. I don't understand what they're doing. It's clear that to convert files to these formats is not that hard. It really isn't. So I'm pretty sure they have a button they push on their end to convert all these items. So why is there a $150 pre-press cost? That doesn't make any sense to me.
See, now, I mean, one of the things that I'm not seeing in this article is are they going through and just doing the conversion, or are they actually putting it up on the stores themselves, acting as an intermediary? Over in the iTunes story, I mentioned specifically that when you use it, if you wish to sell your book, you have to have your sales account ID. Yep. You have to go through and get a sales account from Apple, as you do with each of these different people. Is Graphically going to be acting as publisher and handling all of that, and then just sending you a check every time something is sold?
Yes, that is the way they do it. They are acting as an intermediary. They are selling everything through their Facebook store, and everything is sort of consolidated on a single store in a single app. And that's, yet again, that's the good news. The bad news is they're taking a percentage of every sale as well. So on top of the $150, they're taking a percentage of the sales. And there again, we start to say, okay, what's going on here? Why, when you charge $150, are you also taking percentages of sales? Why not just take percentages of sales? That would make more sense. That's how Apple does it. Apple doesn't charge you to get on the Apple store. They just take a percentage of your store, of your sales.
And print by sales companies like Lulu and Kablam also take a percentage as well, rather than a flat fee up front and then a percentage.
Yeah.
So I can see the advantages of a company like that, but it's the pricing structure that those of us in the know probably have a problem with.
Yeah.
And we're going to wrap up our iTunes and iPad sales stories with an interview with Stephen Pastis, who is the creator of the syndicated comic strip Pearls Before Swine. And he's got an interesting story talking about comic strips in the age of the iPad. Eric?
I'll agree it was an interesting story. I don't know exactly what to say to that. It was interesting. Yes, I think it's something that people should read.
Go read it.
Yeah, go read it.
Well, he does have some interesting facts in there. For example, according to Pastis, an iPad app wasn't a nice-to-have type of thing, but rather a necessity, since approximately 1 in 5 books purchased today are e-books.
Mm.
So, I mean, going through and just having the print, he was missing out on a completely different market by not having his collections in an e-book form.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is that the same for web comics though. Well, we already have ours in an ebook form,
right? And he actually uses Penny Arcade and The Oatmeal and Cyanide and Happiness as examples, as models for the future.
Yeah,
but then he does round off the article talking about the power and the danger of the social web for an artist. Yeah, to where you can lose as well as gain in something like this. I disagree with him on this, because he talks about artists have traditionally created best in a vacuum, as opposed to getting the instant feedback that you do through something like webcomics and the forums or the chat rooms or the shoutcasts.
Yeah, well, I can sort of see why he would say that, because there is a dual-edged sword to having instant connection to your audience. I mean, if you're an interesting and nice guy, it's a real advantage to be able to connect to your audience. If you're a jerk, people find out you're a jerk really fast, and it can hurt you.
Is that just speaking from experience?
Oh. Why are you making me cry, Tom? No,
because I'm a jerk too.
Yeah.
If you're a certain type of jerk, also, you could do really well.
Yeah, if you're an interesting jerk, well, I mean, to a point. If you're an amusing jerk, yes. But if you're just unpleasant, or if you're a little bit crazy, as some comic artists are, it can backfire. I mean, we look at Scott Adams and, you know, and his absolute disasters when interacting with the web, and it's really hurt him on that effect, in that effect. So, you know, I can see that.
But let's go ahead.
Or Liefeld, yeah.
Oh, let's not even get there. You mentioned that, and I know this is a little bit of off topic, but over at Something Positive, yeah, our friend Randy Mulholland over there, he's got a secondary strip over there called Super Stupor.
Right.
And actually gives a nice little jab over at the Image style artist, Sven Liefeld specifically.
Oh yeah, I highly recommend checking that out. And the whole Super Stupor series is pretty good, but yeah, that's a nice one.
But let's go ahead and wrap up. We're going to head back over to geeknews.mtv.com and our friend Sean Kleefeld. We've got to get him back on the show one of these days, Eric.
Yeah, we do.
Who talks about fragmentation in webcomics, and not just how to separate the gutters, but actually the different types of categories that webcomics have just exploded into. He was trying to come up with his Derek Badman was trying to come up with his list of best webcomics of 2011, and he found it difficult because there are so many things, whether it be webcomics or creator blogs or Tumblrs, is it going to be Gag-A-Day or serial strips or journal comics, and there are just so many types of things out there, as opposed to 10, 15 years ago when Sluggy Freelance was one of the few around.
Yeah. And this is one of the big challenges that are sort of facing webcomics as they become more fragmented, because there becomes a point where you sort of say, all right, everything is a webcomic, you know, and is everyone a cartoonist then? And is everything, you know, how can you make a best of when you're now saying everything on the web is now qualified to be a best of it? It's just too big. So there is a sort of fragmentation, but that's sort of the nature of webcomics, of catering to niche audiences at the same time.
It's both the positive and the negative. Yep. Is that everyone can create a webcomic, but on the flip side, you know, everyone can create a webcomic.
Yeah, exactly.
But I want to go ahead and end off with a correction from last week. I mentioned about the mega upload arrests.
Right.
And I actually got something wrong. I wanted to specify, because it seemed like the timing is still a little suspect, but the case against Mega Upload just wasn't something that was cobbled together overnight. This was an investigation that has literally taken a couple of years to get through, and it was with the working with the authorities down in New Zealand as well as here in the U.S.
Yes.
So it was there's no doubt about what it is. I mean, I'll probably never be called for the jury pool. But for those who know, I mean, Kim.com.
Yes. Here's my take on this. This investigation was going on for years. And I think that this investigation was waiting for the PIPA and SOPA bills to pass so that those extended powers could be used in the investigation. When PIPA and SOPA failed, they decided to pull the trigger on the investigation because they had to throw a bone to, you know, the people who had lobbied for that bill. And they say something, look, we're still accomplishing things. You know, the millions of dollars you spent to try to lobby for this bill were not wasted.
And actually, so, I mean, I find that ironic on two fronts because, A, I mean, it shows that SOPA and PIPA were not needed for something like this. And because of the resources that they had over in Virginia, SOPA would not have applied at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it would have been easier to deal with. I think it would still have been easier to have those powers. And I think that, when you get right down to it, that's what those bills were all about. It makes our life easier. It makes it so much easier to go after these people, and we don't want – I mean, it's a little bit of legislative laziness because it's going to be very expensive to get Kim.com over into this country. There has to be extradition procedures. There's going to be pushback. It's going to be a expensive endeavor to do this, and if there was extended powers, it would have been a lot easier. You could have just shut down the site – worldwide, you could have said, that's it, we're done. And it would have been a lot easier to do that instead of having to work with other governments. You can simply say, we're cutting it off. So I think it's one of those things where it's still a situation where they were just trying to get something easier, and they had the tools all the time. They just wanted more tools.
I agree on that. And I think it's a great cautionary tale because I've heard a lot of people griping because, you know, we had our stuff stored up in Mega Upload. We had our backups up on Mega Upload. You know, that is one of my big things about cloud computing is that if you have your – if something happens or if you lost your connection, this is things that you're going to be losing. Don't put anything up that you either, A, can't afford to lose, with all apologies to Carbonite and the other manufacturers of stuff like that out there. And it's also going to be a situation of somebody else is going to be controlling that data. I mean, who do you really want storing your data?
Yep. And speaking, I want to add this small news article because it affects me directly, but it affects a lot of other news web comics out there. DreamHost has been down for nearly half a day now. And speaking of losing your data, you know, don't trust that your website will always be there and storing your information. It could very easily go down, and you could very easily lose all that data, as is maybe happening with DreamHost right at this very moment as we are speaking. So,
and here I thought this was going to be your pirate story. But I think this wraps up that show. I want to thank my guests here, my co-hosts, from BladeBunny.com, Eric Kimball.
Hi, me matey. Thank you for having on me on.
You turned into an Irish pirate.
I can't do accents.
Our associate news editor, Jason Strasberg.
Yar. That's it.
And from 910 Comics, that's 910cmx.com. I'm Thomas Revor, and we will see you in the funny papers. Arrrr.